This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
Is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Welcome to the Sword and Laser. I'm Veronica Belmont, and Tom will not be joining us this week because we are going to be presenting an interview that was pre-recorded at the 2012 Nebula Awards. I was joined by friend of the show, Josh Lawrence, of course, the composer of our wonderful theme music, and forum mod extraordinaire. Now, over the course of the Nebula Awards, we were able to interview three authors that I think you guys are really going to enjoy. This first episode features Kim Stanley Robinson, who actually ended up winning Best Novel for his book 2312 in this year's Nebula Awards. So without further ado, and apologies for any weird audio issues, I was using a recording device that I don't normally use too often. Please enjoy our interview with Kim Stanley Robinson. We are joined by Kim Stanley Robinson. Thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
How have your Nebulas been so far?
It's been a really fun day. I just have been here a couple few hours, but it's so filled with old friends.
All right, well, our first question comes from Sandy. They want to know, I'm currently listening to 2312, and I'm totally blown away by the descriptions of life in the solar system. I love the way the city on Mercury stays ahead of the sunrise by constantly moving on tracks. It's genius. Anyhow, I always remember reading The Wild Shore back in the 80s. I live in Orange County and found it intriguing, but I never read the other two. The Three Californias trilogy seems to be out of print. Have you considered self-publishing in e-books? I've noticed that quite a few established authors are doing that with out-of-print titles because the publisher holds the e-book rights.
Well, it is a good plan, but I think what is going to happen is that those books will be e-published by Tor.
Oh, okay. And
that's an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm.
The books are in print from Tor Orb as trade paperbacks, and it's actually quite a beautiful edition where the three covers are matched, and it's called The Three Californias, which was a late name for those three books. So that's all happening, and... Yeah, I'm glad that they're being remembered.
So Tor is doing the DRM-free ebook publishing, right?
I think they're experimenting with that. Yeah.
Do you have any feelings about DRM-free or rights management in that sense for ebooks?
No, I don't. I'm pleased that there are ebooks. I'd rather have them than not, and I don't think that the what I try to do is learn from my younger friend and guru, Cory Doctorow. Mm-hmm. And so he's been pretty persuasive that it's counterproductive and that one can consider these things to be either investments or part of the gift economy. So I'm still such a bookish person anyway. I don't have an e-reader of my own. I really like the idea of them, and I like the look of my son's Kindle. Mm-hmm. But it's not something I think about very much.
Well, if you have questions about that, Corey is definitely...
He's
the evangelist. Yeah.
He is a source of information, there's no doubt.
Can't be him for sure.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Chris says that, he says, love the trilogy about Mars. Wondering if any real-life people influenced you on the characters for that series.
Yes, I can get myself in trouble. My wife is a principal source for one of those characters, but cleverly concealed from her by making it one of the men. Hopefully she'll never hear this, but really Sax Russell owes a whole lot to my wife. and that was a huge pleasure. A lot of people are very fond of Sax Russell as a character, which mm-hmm. it pleases me immensely. And then for the rest of them, really not. I'd have to say that gang in the Mars books, I love them dearly, and I don't know where they came from, because they seem to speak for themselves or for Mars. It was a glorious experience to have so many strangers speaking to me and getting to know them. The story situation asked for certain kinds of characters, and then they either, over the course of the hundreds of pages, they either became pretty good or really alive, one or the other. Mm-hmm. And so it was a wonderful writing experience.
Well, don't worry. No one listens to our show, so.
No, I'm sure they
she'll
do.
Never find out.
Actually, she's a big fan of podcasts, but sorry, Lisa, you had to find out someday.
Our next question comes from First Name, and that is actually his forum handle, so mm-hmm. I'm not just making that up. Did the Years of Rice and Salt idea have its genesis from your reading of The Man in the High Castle at all? If not, what made you choose which society to conquer?
Well, those are Man in the High Castle is one of the great alternative histories, and I definitely had read it fairly early on in my science fiction reading. I would reckon somewhere in the early 70s. And somewhere in the mid to late 70s, I was doing alternative histories, and so probably The Man in the High Castle was a big influence. But I had an idea for this one, that what if all of the Europeans had died in the Black Death, which is the Years of Rice and Salt, but it was too big of an idea to write. I couldn't do it because it involved, 700 years of history and really should have been a fat novel. And this was the mid-70s. I barely was writing novels at all, just short stories. Mm-hmm. So I wrote The Lucky Strike, and I wrote a few other alternative histories where I was getting a handle on what alternative histories do. And I just banked that thought for many years until I had finished the Mars books. And the structure of the Mars books, covering 200 years, convinced me that I had a workable form and that I had my novel writing capabilities up to speed to where I could give it a try. So it was probably 20 to 25 years between when I had the idea for mm-hmm. Years of Rice and Salt and when I actually wrote the book.
You actually bring up a really interesting point. For new writers, sometimes it's hard to kind of grapple with these big ideas that they come up with and they want to be able to put on paper. But now that you've come, obviously, so far in your career, what would you say to a new writer who has a big idea like the one you just mentioned and doesn't really know how to contain it, doesn't really know how to make it something workable?
Well, I would say first write it down somewhere so that you don't forget it or get hit in the head. Mm-hmm. And then I would hold on to it until you felt like you'd found the proper form for telling it. And if it's obviously a novel idea, then you ought not to try writing it before you've done other novels if you feel it's a really good idea.
And don't try to contain it.
And also don't do it a short story. And it probably doesn't even serve, although I have done this, you might try taking a small fragment of it and writing a short story about it that maybe gives you the moral right to being the first one to have written about it.
You have to date that.
Well, you hope to get it published. I the reason I thought of that is because I had this title called Green Mars, and I thought, you know, Science Fiction Writers of America, like here we're at their convention, there's 500 to 1,000 of us, and I wasn't ready to write this giant novel, Green Mars, but the title struck me as really obvious and really good. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a climbing short story, called it Green Mars, and then at least I had the first claims on that title.
Right.
And that story never even fit into the novel as I completed it, but wow. I did it for the title. So I guess that's what I would recommend to people is just pay attention. And one thing about short story ideas, they're very different from novel ideas. And if you try to tell a big, super dramatic or melodramatic or at least many characters, lots of events in a short story, you're likely to do a disservice to it. And there's something tricky about short stories where they have to do something significant in just a few pages. So mm-hmm. I always tell writing students, instead of making it be a whole lot of events, try moving something that weighs 1,000 pounds an inch, but maybe an inch onto the toes of the reader so that they feel it. And so short stories have a peculiar motion to them.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice. I might have to try that with a particular idea I've been struggling with.
I have the opposite problem. I think I had a short story idea that I tried to turn into a book.
You see that a lot.
I would have been better served as a short story.
We've all done that. That happens.
Well, this next question also ties into that evolving a large work. Alan says, to me, the characters of the Mars books and their political views became more realistic and more nuanced as the books progressed. Do they feel the same way to you, or is it just a reader artifact from spending more time with them? If it is actually occurring throughout the work, was that pre-planned?
That's a good question, and I feel the same way about it. And I think it was not pre-planned. It was more a matter of exploration, getting to know characters better. I think the best example of this is Maya, who in Red Mars, she gets, I think, maybe even the second chapter and is a relatively superficial and hard to comprehend character. Mm-hmm. Then her chapters in Green Mars and then in Blue Mars, I feel, are amongst the best chapters in those books, and that Maya is infinitely deeper and more complex than in Red. Same thing happened with Sax, because he was a minor character in Red Mars. And at the end of Red Mars, Frank and John and Arcady have all died. And I thought to myself, what have I just done? I mean, all the major male characters are dead, and now
spoiler
I've got two
alert.
More.
Spoiler alert!
Oh, well. We assume most of the people who will listen to this.
These are books that are 20 years old, so if you haven't read it yet, spoilers are.
You'd be surprised what they get upset about on the forums.
Okay, well, maybe you can cut this.
She'll just put red flax,
klaxon
alarm.
What we can do is we can say that most of the major male characters had somehow absconded at the end of Red Mars, and I needed volunteers, and Sax, this little nerdy tech guy in a lab coat, raised his hand and said, I can step in here, and I was amazed. But then I wrote that chapter called The Scientist as Hero, which is speaking to this problem. And that is a very good chapter, The Scientist as Hero, where Sax steps into his own. And I had no idea when I was writing Red Mars. So I think that happened, because really these books took maybe, 8 or 9 years to write. Wow. So I was living with them a long time.
Yeah. That's always so fascinating to me, how authors can work on a book for like you said, almost a decade, and these characters are just living with them throughout that whole time. And I feel like you would have such a close connection with them that it would be almost impossible to stop writing at some point. Because is that almost like ending a relationship?
Or do you get exhausted by them at some point?
It's an interesting question, because in a way it speaks to that part of novel writing that is like Calvin with Hobbes. And what happens is, Hobbes turns back into just that doll that other people see him as. He's not alive as he is for Calvin to other people. It's a beautiful part of Calvin and Hobbes. And so I try to always keep it remembering that, it's just a puppet there sitting next to you. It's not a real person. And novels should have endings. So it's important that you make a satisfactory ending to a novel and not start spinning off sequels forever, which is a terrible habit that comes out of the commercial side of science fiction. So when I finish a novel, it is sad because they stop speaking. They go still like Hobbes. And the only solution is to say, wait a second, it was an imaginary construct to begin with. Let's just start another novel. Mm. So you just get back into the next one. And don't get too sentimental about your own hallucinations.
That's great. So the next question comes from Darren. And he says, Antarctica is right at the tippy top of my list of dream vacations, weirdly. Mm. And I've read that book every couple of years, and I always enjoy it. In a lot of ways, the plots of Antarctica and Red Mars are mirrors of each other. Eco-terror, hidden bands of misfits, breakers versus gearheads, isolation, stowaways. As Red Mars came first, I was wondering how much of the secret life of Antarctica we see in your book was true to your experience there.
Well, that's an excellent question. The culture of Antarctica was a wonderful thing to experience because I wasn't making it up. It was there. It was wild and inventive, creative, something that one person couldn't have thought up. So much of what I wrote about was there, or else it was in the surround. There is eco-terrorism. There are people doing their best to live off the grid in Antarctica, not in a formal way like in my book, but in working for the companies and for the governments that put you down there, people do their best to still keep their own projects and their own sense of the place going. So it was, a lot of it was Antarctica, and then some of it was me repeating those elements from before, the utopian elements. It would be hard to live off the land in Antarctica because you aren't really on land, you're on ice. Mm-hmm. So but then again, high tech is high tech, and during the summer months when the sun is shining, you could do a kind of greenhouse existence and have the greenhouses actually be big ice boats. It's all kind of beautiful in terms of an imaginative space. But then when the winter comes, it's 6 months of pure darkness and your greenhouse wouldn't work, etc. So I think it would have to be a seasonal sort of occupation like it really is. And many a person has asked me, and dead seriously, is there water slides underneath the South Pole? And I have to think, well, okay, the book must have worked because there's no way in hell that there's water slides underneath the South Pole. But the mixture of the real and the imaginative have been so mixed together that at a certain point you can't de-strand them. So you just think, well, it all must be real, which is really what near future science fiction should be doing.
I have that same problem actually reading alternate history just in general, because if I don't know enough about the true history that they're relating about, then I
it
have
becomes
to ask
the actual like, history that you start yeah. referencing, right?
I'm like, maybe that was probably not actually happening at that time. But anyway,
yeah, especially if the storytelling is so great that it's completely believable.
Yes.
So
one thing that happened in Antarctica is just recently, in my book, I predicted that there would be people reproducing the classic expeditions, you know, making Scott's march to the pole, et cetera, including Amundsen. And some of my main characters are reproducing Amundsen's walk to the pole when they get in trouble. And I talked about my main character, Val, who's a mountain guide. She had been traumatized by an expedition that had gone wrong trying to reproduce Shackleton's boat journey and crossing to South Georgia. Well, just this January, they reproduced Shackleton's boat journey and crossing to South Georgia. And it's a perfect reproduction of the boat, and they even wore wool and leather and did not get into modern gear and only used a sextant. In short, they did exactly what I had predicted like 15 years before.
Wow.
So that's one of my few science fiction predictions that has come true.
That came absolutely true.
Very true. And I followed it daily on the blog.
Well, Sean has a question about predictions in your book 2312. He says, you portray Africa as not much different in the future than it was in the 20th century. Why do you think nothing much is going to change there in the next 300 years?
Well, that's a good question. There are there's kind of two parts to it. One, the world of 2312 has to be read two ways, which is the usual science fiction binocularity. It's a future world, 300 years from now, but that is also a symbol for the way the world is right now. Mm-hmm. So in talking about the way the world is right now, and in that world, we would be the spacers, right? And you come back down to Earth that still has a peasant culture that is still living like it's the year 1300 all around Eurasia and in South America and even parts of North America. So that's one of the reasons that Africa is still the same, because the whole book is a portrait of now. Now, the other answer is, could in 300 years, if we don't make development, equality, and justice the project, the main project of civilization, and you have 9 billion people on the planet, what I postulate is the forgotten ones, a billion or two people, like right now, 7 billion people on the planet, about 2 billion are going to bed hungry every night. Well, what's going to change that if it's just capitalism? Nothing. There is no rising tide, and therefore it does not float all boats. It is differential. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. And so unless we make it a project, specifically the project of civilization, it won't change. And so this is a future in which they haven't made it specifically the project, and so it hasn't changed. Now, in the tropics is where it's hardest to do human health. And Africa has this bad post-colonial history. The colonialism was bad. The post-colonial hasn't gone great so far. And I'm postulating in this book that there's been balkanization, that instead of being 190 countries in the UN, there's some, I think I've listed like 460. Luckily, I didn't list them, but I say there are 400.
That could be an appendix.
I make a lot of lists in that book, but not that one. And I imply that even Zimbabwe, which is particularly troubled country after in Rhodesia to Zimbabwe, well, and I had read a little bit about Harare, and had an interest in that area, and I broke it down into almost every subdivision of the capital city as a country of its own. And in the Balkanization, development is just very difficult. So a combination of geographical and political factors that meant that Africa in this scenario was still messed up.
All right. Well, our next question comes from Alter Jess, who says, would you volunteer for a one-way colonization mission to Mars? Why or why not?
Well, no way. Not a ghost of a chance. One of the reasons why is because I spent a week at the South Pole, and it was by far the least interesting of my time in Antarctica, because I was in a, it was too cold and there was nowhere to go but the ice, and so we spent a lot of time indoors in these little rooms. That's what Mars would be like. If you read Red Mars carefully, you see that the first 100 in the first, say, 20 years that they're there are living underground most of the time to avoid the radiation. And unless you had a really vigorous terraforming campaign, that remains the state forever. So it's like saying, would you stay indoors for the rest of your life? And I wouldn't do that anywhere. Not anywhere. And Mars is just like the Southwest with bigger features. So what's the thrill? It's a lot of people are thrilled by the abstract idea. Oh my gosh, we would be on Mars. Well, that might last about a month, and then after that, you're stuck in a room underground, and you might as well be in Peoria, Illinois. So I would never do it. If we had a terraformed Mars, or even a non-terraformed Mars, and what you could do is get a really fast rocket there and spend some time exploring, and then a fast rocket back home, well, yes. That resembles what I did in Antarctica, and I loved it. I loved that trip. Enormously. And I believe the same thing would be fun for Mars. But, you know, the fast rocket isn't going to happen for a super long time. The fastest we're going to get, given our current technologies, it'd be more like 9 months there, 2 years there to get back in position, 9 months back home.
That's still worth it to me.
A lot of scientists, and ordinary people would say yes to that.
Yeah.
I myself wouldn't. I'd like to be outdoors too much.
I've got a lot of books to read.
I'm willing to imagine it. I'm willing to look at the pictures and maybe put on 3D glasses. To tell you the truth, I spent my 9 years on Mars looking at Viking photos. So in essence, I was looking at you guys like this because the photos were really poorly done. And then the Mars Global Surveyor started taking its pictures, and the Curiosity on the surface and the Sojourner and the other ones. And it's like suddenly I'm seeing Mars like this. So already I feel like I'm being handed Mars in a way that I never was before when I was working on it.
Yeah.
And I also have to say, it was a novel. It wasn't my life's goal. It was my life's biggest novel. And once I'm finished with a novel, what I'm interested in is the next one. So,
So you would want a time machine first that would
put me back
to thoroughly greenified Mars, and then you would go.
Or cryogenics.
Or cryogenics, perhaps.
The time machine sounds good. I would love to see a greened Mars. If humanity does that, that is going to be very special.
That would be amazing.
For me, I do that every summer. I go to the High Sierra of California. And so we're way above tree line. We're at, 10 to 14,000 feet. And I feel like I'm in the most beautiful landscape I can even imagine. And I get that, here on Earth. If they do similar things to Mars as a kind of landscape gardening or landscape architecture, whatever you call it, well, that's a whole planet that is going to be just mind-boggling. It will be very, very beautiful.
Yeah, I would love to see that. Alden Anil says, the characters in Red Mars are experts in a wide variety of scientific fields. How did you approach researching all of the disparate fields of experience?
Well, I did it on the need-to-know basis. As I saw what point of view character I had for a given scene and what a chapter I was in, what I needed to know to tell that scene, I would then research accordingly. So my different characters have slightly different expertises. And I would then follow them accordingly. And that worked fine. It was, the research never ended. So it wasn't like you research first and then write the book. Mm-hmm. Much more interactional and ongoing.
Did it ever feel like a burden for you, or were you always excited to learn what you needed to know?
Always super interesting. I like all those topics. The only one that I have to say I was completely defeated by was aerodynamics. Hmm. There'd be a little talk about, well, when you're growing a Martian atmosphere, what then, and a very tall vertical relief of landscape, so what then would the atmosphere act like? So, and some of the Martian literature even talks about the current atmosphere there, so I tried to read that, I tried to comprehend aerodynamics.
Yeah. You had to say sorry.
No, sorry. This goes way over my head. Not even the first paragraph would be comprehensible to me when it comes to aerodynamics.
And our final question comes from Josh. Is that you, Josh?
Yes, it is. It's me, Josh.
You can ask the question then.
All right. Your upcoming book, Shaman, looks at humanity's distant past instead of its possible future. What inspired the shift of focus, and what research did you do? I think you've actually talked about some of it in your other questions, but what research did you do for this book's Paleolithic setting?
Well, I've been interested in the Paleolithic for a long time. I think that we were a high-tech civilization going way back, and our tech being in wood, leather, cloth, and bone and stone, that when we look only at the stones, that's all that's lasted. We're having a hard time imagining how they lived and what they were like. So these cave paintings are indicative and give you the a sense of what their religion must have been like, and their close relationship with animals, obviously, because they're mostly animal paintings and very few human paintings. So for many years, it's one of these things that for 20 years I've thought, at some point I've got to do a Paleolithic novel and speak to these issues because I'm super interested. Because it also is applicable to what are we now and how could we best be happy right now on the planet? Well, to answer that question, you need to think about what we were in the Paleolithic when we evolved into what we are now. Well, we evolved kind of a little bit before the Paleolithic, but you see what I'm saying. So then they've discovered this Chauvet cave in France. Well, two things happened. They discovered the dead body of an alpine man who had been crossing a pass in the Alps, died, got frozen in a glacier, and all his gear frozen with him, as in some kind of science fiction scenario. This was around the same time that they discovered the Chauvet cave that was in the recent Werner Herzog movie.
Oh, okay.
Now the alpine man is only about 5,000 years old, but except for his copper axe, everything that he had on him probably was deeply conserved and been used by humans similarly to that for 20, 40, 50, 60,000 years. We have no idea, but it probably goes way back because all of it is intuitive and using natural materials. And we've been smart for 80,000 years or 150,000 years. We don't really know because we don't know when we got language. And I think language was the moment when we really became ourselves. So I put it all together and I thought, well, what am I going to do? What moment do I pick? What situation? Where's my story? And then that Chauvet cave, when I looked at those paintings, I thought, let's tell the story of the people who painted that cave. So then you get to the religion, and the shaman religion is obviously really ancient because we find it everywhere on Earth. Tip of Tierra del Fuego, Siberia, all over the Americas, all over Eurasia, and in Africa, you have this same religion. So if you run it backwards, like a backwards movie, like people do with linguistics or with DNA studies now, it all comes back to Africa. It looks like it might be the first religion, and in any case, really ancient. So 32,000 years ago in that cave, they were probably practicing a religion that even then was thousands of years old. And those distances in time are so hard for us, and yet they're kind of science fictional distances in time, right? They're something that science fiction is used to discussing. And so I thought of this as a science fiction novel all along. Without archaeology, you wouldn't know about the cave and the people. And without the carbon dating and the various kinds of dating of the paints, you wouldn't know that it was 32,000 years ago that this paint was. Which, when they got that date, since Lascaux is 17,000 years old, they didn't expect this cave to be nearly twice as old. It was a mind-boggler. So I think of this as my next step in my science fiction obsessions. And then lastly, I should add, this Sierra time, I spend a lot of time out in the wilderness, and it is a very high-tech activity. My backpack is very sophisticated. The stuff in it really resembles the Alpine Man in terms of what it does for you. His kit looked a lot like my kit, which is part of the inspiration. But then my friends and I, we do snow camping, And we're not good skiers. We always now are on snowshoes. So we clomp around up there in the snow after it's settled a little so that you're not going to get killed by avalanches. Mm-hmm. And so mostly spring snow camping. And that also is very Paleolithic. I know what it feels like to be cold, to work in the snow, to put up a shelter and to be comfortable in the snow, which is really the whole point of that activity. So I felt like I could write this book a little bit, aspects of this book out of my own experiences. And it really seemed like it was my book to write, and that was a very special feeling.
Jeez, you know, I just have to say, what I would give to have an eighth of the knowledge you have about everything you've talked about in this interview and these experiences. It's just, you've had such an incredible set of life experiences and knowledge to draw from for your writing. It's just amazing.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm glad you say that because truthfully, I feel like, and I'm proud to say this, that my biography would fit on the back of an envelope. And that really I've done nothing. I've been a suburban Mr. Mom. I've brought up my kids. I've wrote my books. And I've gone to the Sierras as my leisure activity. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's been a novelist's life is really sitting on your butt in front of a laptop. It is labor-intensive. It's time-intensive. And I like it. And I, you know, I'm a gardener and a suburban Mr. Mom. But what I like about your comment is that in that context of utter American normality and unexceptionalism, I have found a lot of fun things to do and interesting things to think about and pursue and study and read. It's been a beautiful life. The reading, it's the literature, I think, that sparks it all to life. Mm-hmm. If you love reading, then you get to live like 10,000 lives. It's like telepathy. It's like time travel. It's space travel. It's everything that you would want. Mental voyaging, as William Blake called it. And so I think it's literature and that process of the imagination that has launched me out of American suburban normality into all these more exciting moments, and they've been pretty frequent. And I'm grateful to be a Californian and to have the Sierras right next door. I mean, that really is a gift that that one landscape can give you so much.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a great note to end the interview on. Thank you so much for taking the time to answer our group's questions today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
All right, everyone, thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, our email address is feedback@swordandlaser.com. Our website is swordandlaser.com, and all of our discussions happen over on Goodreads. We have a regular episode coming up next week, but in our off weeks when we don't have a regular episode, stay tuned for more interviews from the Nebula Awards. We have upcoming interviews with Joe Haldeman and Gene Wolfe.